Sairam, dear listeners, it's another beautiful Thursday morning. It's about 11 a.m., which means it's time for Radio Sai Answering Booth. Where the questions are yours, the answers are his, and well, I'm the dispenser. I'm Prem from Team Radio Sai. It's my pleasure to welcome you all to Prashanti Through the Digital. It's a beautiful day here. The weather is as pleasant as it can be. Not too gloomy, not too sunny, not too warm, not bitterly cold either. And as we are just a few days away from Guru Purnima, devotees have already started trickling in. This is also the time many overseas devotees plan their annual pilgrimage, so I could see at least one large group already. But that's it for Prashanti Updates, because this is a question and answer show and we have a very interesting question to answer today. Before that, an interesting quote is lined up too. So as always, let's begin by offering our most humble pranams at Swami's lotus feet and let's head to the quote of the week. The last time around, I read a quote from a little known source. But the quote I'm going to read today is from a person whom the chances that you will know him are almost 100%. And he is Barack Obama, the 44th President of the United States, who completed his term not long ago, just at the beginning of this year. So here comes the quote. We the people recognize that we have responsibilities as well as rights, that our destinies are bound together, that a freedom which only asks what's in it for me, a freedom without commitment to others, a freedom without love or charity or duty or patriotism, is unworthy of our founding ideals and those who died in the defense of them. End of quote. It's a simple quote. Those are words from a modern politician, so they don't need much deciphering. But the topic he speaks of is of much relevance today. You know, modern society is dangerously moving towards a state where we only think of our rights and freedoms. We want freedom of expression, freedom of speech, right to education, right to opportunities, and so on. Well, it's absolutely not wrong to seek rights for all in an egalitarian society. But it is dangerous to keep rights as the foundation of the way we interact in a society. In the process, we make entitlements the foundation of society, and that's the dangerous part of it. When that happens, we promote grabbing, groupism, and fragmentation. Yes, we have cases of people fighting for the rights of the underprivileged, but that's right in many ways, because educated people, when they come forward to fight for the rights of those who are unaware of their rights, they're actually performing their duty towards society in a sense. So in that sense, it is not wrong. But in the process, with a good intention of informing people of what they are entitled to, I wonder if we have made rights the basis of our interaction with society itself. And this has repercussions in various levels of social life, in schools, in families, in neighborhoods. And slowly, the legal system too starts becoming biased towards protecting rights versus enforcing duties. And in fact, a liberal system can never enforce rights as much as it can ensure freedom. And more than anything, this is very, very dangerous for a spiritual life. In the question I answer today, I will make a reference to this aspect, but for now, I will say this much, that if we want our future generations to have a spiritual foundation, we must live duty-bound lives rather than rights-driven lives. And then raise children repeatedly emphasizing the importance of duty. As Swami would say innumerable number of times, the essence of the Bhagavad Gita is Mama Dharma, my duty. And we go through life stopping at every situation and circumstance and asking this question, what is my duty, what is my dharma? We will automatically lead a spiritual life. And Swami says, what is your right will of course come to you. There is no doubt about that when you perform your duty diligently. But when we go through life constantly asking, what is my entitlement? What is rightfully mine? As Obama says, what's in it for me? Our lives automatically become materialistic and worldly. So before we head to the question, permit me, dear listeners, to read that quote by Barack Obama one more time. We the people recognize that we have responsibilities as well as rights, that our destinies are bound together, that a freedom which only asks what's in it for me, a freedom without a commitment to others, a freedom without love or charity or duty or patriotism, is unworthy of our founding ideals and those who died in their defense. So let's head to the question of the week. Today's question is from a person who has sent us a couple of questions before already. It's from Mrs. Praveena Kilpadi from Delhi. She's been, as always, kind to send the question in her own voice. So first we'll listen to the question, then we will go into answering that question, of course, based on what Swami has said before.
Sai Ram, all of us face this problem living in India, and I feel a lot of people will benefit from your response to this question. Why is it that despite living in a culturally and spiritually rich country, a majority of us in India are selfish and inconsiderate towards others, be it by cutting queues, refusing to offer seats to the elderly, blaring loudspeakers at religious places, or paying bribes to get our way around roadblocks? In Delhi, where I live, the wealthy often ill-treat the domestic helpers. It is most disheartening. Whereas, in the West, which on the surface seems spiritually bankrupt, most people observe social niceties, follow rules, and take pride in doing things perfectly. What explains this behavior? And how can we as Indians correct our attitudes? This is Praveena Kilpadi from New Delhi. Thank you.
That's an interesting question, and I should say an honest way of looking at the Indian society and the problems that we face. But before I answer the question, let me make a few general points. Most of the answers I give on the show and most of our discussions about Swami's message is definitely based on reasoning. You know, we try to make it based on rational thinking, but it is not off reasoning. When I say that, what I mean is, you know, Swami has taken a stance on many of these themes. And I, on this program, only try to understand the rationale behind it in most cases. In fact, to say that Swami has taken a stance is actually wrong. Swami has revealed what is truly right and wrong. But what we do is try to understand why something is right and why something is wrong. So in general, I may or may not be able to give absolutely convincing explanations. But at the end of the day, what Swami says is right and what Swami says is wrong is what we actually have to go by, whether or not we are able to reason out the rationale behind it. In this topic, you know, what is obvious to us is that in many ways, the Western cultures, as we see them today, seem very superior. And some of the things which you mentioned are definitely true. You know, people are more refined in their behavior. Especially when they come out in the society, they don't break queues, which is a big, big problem in India. There seems to be more sympathy and far less corruption. There's more honesty in general. There's a very, very good amount of dignity of labor. People respect equality and liberty. And, you know, there are a lot of things, especially those who have been able to see the Western societies and are able to see the contrast that we see in Indian cities. We'll completely agree with the question that you've asked us, Mrs. Praveena, because that's what it appears in the outside. But Swami says Indian culture is superior. It is a boon to be born in Indian. That's what Swami says. The past is glorious, no doubt. In fact, all of us know that. We have a very, very glorious and spiritual past that we can be extremely proud of. But Swami speaks highly of even being born in India now as a great blessing, that it gives you a certain advantage. I don't recall the details, but I remember one of my friends was telling about, I think, his sister or somebody who went to this Nadi reading. And if you're familiar with what this Nadi reading is, they're sometimes very, very accurate with your past and what's happened in your life so far. So this person had some problem, and she went to this Nadi reader, and this person, you know, managed to locate that particular document which was meant for her. And he said that, you know, this is what has happened in your life. And he started telling things about her past life. And he narrated how in many, many ways she had been a good person. She tried to help people around. She tried to help the underprivileged. And after he spoke about all that the good things that she had done in her past, you know, finally the document said, and because of all these blessings, you are born an Indian, right? And this is something which Swami himself reflects, and I'm not trying to portray being Indian as something very, very superior, not from my point of view, but that is what it seems, and that is what it seems that Swami also is conveying, and we've heard that in many of Swami's discourses. So what that means is, though what appears to be true is different from what Swami says. And whenever that happens, that what meets your eye is different from what Swami says, the thing is, what is obvious is not as true as we think it is. The truth is actually deeper than what really meets our eye. That is the conclusion that we have to come to, and I think that's the same thing here too. And that is why we'll have to go into and see, in spite of all the differences that you mentioned, in what way is the Indian culture more superior, Indian culture as it is today. As it was in the past, it was glorious that we all know, but as it is even today, can we say that being born in India is actually a special boon in any way? Second point, I'm certainly not trying to put down any other country or culture in the course of this answer. If that's how I sound, I'm extremely sorry about that. In fact, some of the great things about Indian culture could in fact be observed in many Western civilizations and countries till as not long before as the turn of the last century, right? The 19th century. But somehow these aspects have been retained in this land, whereas the modernization has managed to, literally wash away some of these important aspects of culture in the West. And lastly, being born in India may certainly give us an advantage, but end of the day, we as individuals have to recognize and make use of it. Or whatever is our current state, we must make a conscious effort to progress, right? Which sadly many of us Indians are not doing, especially as you mentioned in cities. We are far from being Indian. In fact, if time permits, I'll tell a small chinakatha which Swami usually says about saying how hollow our pride of being Indian really is. But of course, that if time permits. I'll start off from the point I just made that, you know, wherever we are born, we are human beings at the end of the day, and there are some things which are common. You could be born in America, you could be born in Europe, you could be born in Africa, you could be born in India, but there are some things that being a human, there are commonalities in this, and those cannot be discounted. On the negative side, let's start with the positives. On the positive side, we all have what Swami says is the conscience, right? Whoever you are, male, female, child, elder, younger, corrupt, honest, whatever is your, however you will describe a person, that person has a conscience within, and Swami says that conscience is divine. So whoever turns within will be able to access divinity and the same divinity. That's what the essence of all Vedanta is. The divinity which you find within is the same divinity which is in all. That's what even Krishna tells Arjuna. He says the Kshetrajna is your real nature, that Kshetrajna, and that is common in every person that you come across. So that is the positive side which is common in all human beings. And the negative side is that we all are chained by our own selfishness. And Swami would often say, Swartham Swaprayojanam, selfishness and self-interest. This is common for all of us, but we all have different levels of selfishness. You know, that's what differentiates people between people who are good and people who are not so good, right? The levels of selfishness. How selfish can you become? How selfless can you become, right? The extremes, the very, very selfish people and the very, very selfless people, you know, these people will stand out in any culture, in any society. And those are the ones who stand the test of time, whose fame lasts over centuries and centuries, and we speak about them, both, even the very, very evil and even the very, very good, because they stand out in whichever culture they are, right? But for most of us who are in that average level of selfishness, and we all have that little bit of selflessness too, we are in different levels. We are in, you know, we are not the worst, we are not the best, but in between, but there are differences between how good I am versus how good someone else can be. But this gradient or this variation of who's more selfish and who's more selfless will not be seen, and rather will be seen based on how they are measured, how you are looking at this gradient. A simple example I'll give you in the earlier years, where the Indian exam system, especially the university exam, they used to have only probably three or four categories. Either you fail or you've just passed, which would be something like the second class or something like that. And then you have a first class, And then you're a gold medalist, right? So if you're a failure or if you're a gold medalist, wherever you are, you can be pointed out. But if you are in this first class, that used to be a very, very ambiguous section. If you score more than 60%, you enter the first class. So which means somebody who's got even a 90% would still be in the first class. The reason I'm referring to this system is, this system, because it has a very, very wide demarcation, you will never be able to see the gradients in that. But the moment you bring in a grade system, where you say that 50 to 60 is a particular grade, 60 to 70 is an A grade, 70 to 80 is an O grade, and 80 and above is an O plus, automatically you can scrutinize the gradient more and you can even start sieving, right? Which means if I choose to scrutinize more, the gradients in the system will become more visible. Same is the case with this quality of selfishness. A person who appears perfectly good, it might be appearing like a very decent person in public, can behave completely in an opposite manner when the interests of that person are in danger. Right? So if I'm selfish, but if the system that I am part of, the society I'm a part of, can take care of my selfish needs, I don't have a necessity to assert my selfishness. Right? So the real sieving actually happens when people are faced with insecurities. If you're put in a society where you're insecure, you're not sure you'll get what you need, you're not sure whether you'll see the next day with the amount of food that you need for the next day. When insecurities come in, then there is this necessity to assert your selfishness, and you will assert as selfish as you are. So in most often what happens is, generally a lot of people are of average goodness. So to be really good, to see if that person is really, really good, they have to be pushed to a corner and have to be seen if they will remain good. Those who are good, those who stand the test, will remain good, whatever be the situation, whatever be the insecurity. But most of us are average. And if the government, if the society I'm living in can take care of most of my selfish interests, well, I could be a really good person. You endanger my interests, and that's when my real color actually comes out, right? So the very selfish will be uniformly bad. You put them in a good society, a bad society, they'll be bad. But most of us are in the averages, and most of our goodness depends on the societies that we live in. Let me give you a small example. Let's say in a developed country, you have 7 posts or 7 jobs which have to be taken, and there are probably 10 people vying for the 7 posts. So, that's the amount of pressure that you'll have, that there's a chance, there's a 70% chance of you getting in. And if you don't get in, probably the next job interview you might make the cut. Compare it with a developing country like India, where we have this huge population. For every 7 jobs, you have something like 100 people fighting for those 7 jobs, right? And that makes the pressure on you enormous. 10 people vying for 7 jobs versus 100, sometimes even 1,000 people vying for 7 jobs, right? So that is the amount of insecurity with which you will be going into, this particular interview or this particular recruitment drive. So when you go into that, let's say that of that 100 people, even 2 people have a corrupt mindset. Let's say that they feel that the chance of me getting in is so less that I will have to push my chances further by seeing if there are any holes in the system, if I can manipulate the system. So even if 2 people manage, succumb to this insecurity and succumb to this pressure and say that let's try and rig the system, they will do it, and once a system is rigged, the system becomes open to be rigged further, right? It doesn't require all of the 100 people in the line to become corrupt. It requires only 2 people to be corrupt and to rig the system, and once the system is rigged, it is open to be corrupt after that, right? So when this happens, imagine yourself to be in that 100. Now if 100 people are vying for 7 jobs, you are under enormous pressure. And in that, if you bring in this idea of corruption where some people have already ensured that they will get 2 or 3 of those jobs, then you're left with 100 people or 90 people vying for 4 jobs or 3 jobs. So again, this leads to more insecurity, right? Slowly more and more people will start falling for this insecurity. And when faced with situations like this, there is another option which you have to take to, but we'll come to that later because that's the important part of the answer. But this is what happens when you live in a society like India, and once the corruption sets in, the system gets rigged, then it leads to enormous amount of pressure on the people who are there. So those who are in the average level of goodness, average level of selfishness, will start sieving out into those people who will remain good in spite of whatever the situation, and those who will fall at various levels of pressure during this entire process, right? So what happens when this happens, when such a thing takes place? The system gets rigged, and the system, once compromised, will only get more and more corrupt. So earlier, people would do their best in terms of education or in terms of trying out their, you know, putting their best effort, and then they would look for advantages by rigging the system. You know, I've done my best, but I'm not sure if my best is enough. So let me see if I can, you know, grease somebody's palms, and let's see if anybody is there ready to accept something under the table. But slowly, once the system is rigged, after generations, what will happen is people who are completely incompetent will use the system which is already rigged, and you will find that incompetent people occupying positions of authority. And that's precisely what's happened in our country. And it's not happened on a day. It's happened over many, many centuries. And it doesn't require for an entire country to be corrupt. As I said, it only calls for 2%, 3% to be corrupt, to rig the system. And of course, it'll take a long time to, you know, rejig this whole thing. But we'll, again, come to that a little bit later. But what happens when you create a system like this? A corrupt system eventually becomes money friendly, right? If you have more money, you have more chances of making the cut, which means it's easier for the rich to make more money and the powerful to become more powerful. And when this happens, the gap between the rich and the poor becomes more and more. And this is a very, very dangerous thing which is happening in most societies which are probably growing faster than they should be. There is no sustainable growth. And one of the examples is, of course, our Indian cities. When this happens, when this divide between the poor and the rich constantly keep increasing, this leads to two problems. The rich, influential and powerful, have not earned their position rightly. Earlier, we used to have, you know, some of these IAS officers in top positions, the government officials. They all would have started off in humble backgrounds. They would have worked really hard. They would have worked themselves up the ladder. When your success is based on hard work, there will automatically be humility in the way you rise. But when you rise through the wrong means, when the rich become rich faster, when the powerful become more powerful faster, the humility is left out. And that explains what you were telling about, you know, so many of these rich people don't know how to treat their, domestic helps. They don't know how to treat their subordinates. You have rich people who treat the common people on the road with a lot of condescendence. All of this happens because when growth happens with not backed by effort, not backed by sincere hard work, the humility gets left out, and that is what happens. And the second problem with this thing is, you know, since the poor have been failed by the system is not able to support the poor anymore. So that will lead the poor to take their own means of asserting themselves. If the system gives them an option, like in the West, you know, there are ways by which you can, within the system, raise complaints and raise issues and get your rights. I mean, you can get what is rightfully yours. But once the system starts failing the poor, what will happen is the poor will assert themselves in their own ways. Vigilantism, the Naxalite movement that we see in India. And as survival becomes more and more difficult, you know, how can you expect these people who are below the poverty line to maintain cleanliness and to maintain other manners that we speak of? The courtesies that we speak of, that we see in cities, it's impossible. I mean, you're telling a person who probably is struggling to make ends meet every day. All that is in his mind is about the food he'll be able to manage to get for himself and his family before nightfall. And to him, we are talking about the niceties of life, of how you have to be etiquette and all of that. It doesn't happen. So the more this system gets rigged, which is based on the insecurities which are in a country like ours, and then slowly you have this thing of the divide between the rich and poor increasing, and that will lead to the rich becoming more and more, classless or, very, very lacking in humility, very arrogant, and the poor finding other means of asserting themselves. And you would also find that simple things like there is so much disregard for the, the civic amenities. That is something which we see so often in India, because there is so much anger in these people whom we are as a system failing, right? Before I go ahead, the one thing is, I'm not trying to justify any of this. None of this is justifiable, because according to Swami, you have to be dharmic, and be whatever is the condition, you have to be dharmic. That is what it is. But if you're looking at correcting the system, we have to identify the problems. And these are the reasons why some of these problems have arisen in our society. So I'm not justifying any of these activities, but saying that in many ways, in small, small ways, we are responsible for all of this. What we generally do is, when I spoke about the humans everywhere having this, the selfishness as common and the conscience as common, what I'm trying to say is people everywhere are the same, human beings are the same. But when you're comparing the Indian country or the Indian culture with the modern culture, what you're doing is you're comparing culture, and culture is, as we always use the term even in science, it is the environment that you're providing. Right? It's not about the individuals, but the environment that you're providing. And when you want to study culture, you cannot take a slice of time in history and study it. That would be a very inaccurate way of studying culture. A simple thing is, if you want to know who I am, what kind of a person I am, you'll need to know me for a period of time to understand if I'm a pleasant person or if I'm a patient person, if I'm a person of sweet temper. If you see me on any one particular time of the day, it depends on what happens then, right? Whether I've had my lunch or not had my lunch and things like that. And I would be a very pleasant person or a very unpleasant person depending on my circumstance. So you cannot judge me based on one moment in my day. You'll have to spend some time before you really understand or judge me. Same is the case with all of these cultures. You can't take a slice of history and say that, this is how the Indian society is and this is how the Western society is, and come to a judgment based on that. And that is why it's very important to see the historical context when trying to compare cultures. We are comparing the India of today, which is, with the modernized and liberalized West of today. But actually what we're doing is we are comparing a poor man and his habits and activities with a man who's probably got, enough money and he's got enough people to take care of the cleanliness of his house and his clothes. And that is a very, very unfair comparison to do. So if we see history, most of these countries that we speak of, again, I re-emphasize the fact, I'm not trying to put down any culture, put down any country, but let's look at it as objectively as the reasoning requires. If we see history, most of these countries whose decorum we admire, whose efficacy we admire, have fared very, very badly when given two things. One, as I said, is insecurity. When you're given insecurity, the way you behave is what your true goodness is. And the other is, when you're given power in hand, how you behave is what shows what you truly are. So insecurity and power, the amount of grace that you can show when you have power, and the amount of righteousness that you can show even when you're living in insecure conditions, actually shows who you really are. And in that sense, most of these countries in the West that we admire today for their very, very etiquette societies have fared very badly when given power in their hand. One of the greatest crimes against humanity, the most gross of violations of human rights, genocides, ethnic cleansing, has been perpetrated by the European powers. And that's a reality we cannot run away from, right? And the numbers are staggering. The massacre of the native Indians in the Americas, in the Australia, in Africa, millions and millions of people have been, just in the name of ethnic cleansing, have been removed. And cultures have been forced on them. They're saying that this is the Western culture, you better have it or you you're exterminated. And this is the culture that we cannot forget today when we look at it, a culture where, you know, somebody is offering you a seat in the bus, or somebody is keeping the city clean. We cannot forget this aspect of that culture. It's the same culture. And, you know, closest to home, oh, we speak so much about some of these cultures. You know, one of the greatest tragedies that India has seen in the last 100 years or so is what we call the Bengal famine, which happened in 1943. The numbers are truly staggering. 4 million people died of starvation. Yes, there was a famine, but it was not that they did not have food, but the food which they had was shipped out, and these people were allowed to die. And I mean, these are all historical things. When a letter was sent to Winston Churchill, who was the Prime Minister of England then, he said, so what? You know, they, after all, Indians, I anyway don't like the Indians, and they, you know, breed like rabbits. So it's okay. It's okay if they die. And this is the culture which, you know, I mean, it's not very long ago. It's probably 100 years, 150 years. Even today, there are so many facts coming out of how natives were treated in Africa, natives were treated in Canada, in Americas, in Australia. The slave trade, which was not very, very long ago, probably 100, 200 years ago. And, you know, we speak of the cultures where there is mutual respect and concern for others, but not very long ago, these countries had all of these absolutely unacceptable human behavior. You know, once when we were talking to Venkatraman sir, you know, he was talking about all of these problems our country faces, and, you know, this happens and all of this happens. And he was telling how, you know, the Indian culture, Indian country is going down the drain. So we asked him, sir, so according to you, which are the countries which actually are ideal? Which countries would you look up to? So he named two countries. I mean, let's not go into the names of those countries. He named two countries and he said, look at them. Look at their work ethics. Look at the way they, you know, live in society, and look at their government structure, and look at the sincerity of the way they work, the dignity of labor, and the importance they give for, you know, whatever they do, the innovation, the government structure, and all of that. And interestingly, these were the two countries which, you know, which were involved with maximum atrocities during the World War II. In fact, one of these countries, which is definitely praiseworthy, whatever he was mentioning was praiseworthy, but one of these countries were, you know, were so, I mean, I don't know how to describe that, were reportedly even involved in cannibalism when they were conquering countries. How can you remove this aspect of these Western cultures and look at them and say that, you know, they seem to be more etiquette, they seem to be more kind, and they seem to be... I mean, once again, I'm not comparing the West with India, nothing like that. The human nature is such that when pushed to the corner with insecurity, when entrusted with power, the way you behave is completely different. And if you really want to measure the nature of a person, you have to measure it at that time, right? When they have power and when they are pushed to the corner with insecurities. The Indian culture certainly, you know, has them in many ways, because I spoke about the Bengal famine. You know, the Bengal famine was actually a very regular affair. It used to happen once in five years, once in 6 years regularly. But till almost the colonization of India started, the Bengal famine did not have the amount of toll that it had later, because the kings of that country, those people who had the power, would open their treasury and take care of their citizens to ensure that during the famine they have least trouble. You know, that is what it means. The real culture is when you have the power and when you are faced under these problems, how do you behave? So what we have to do when we're talking about the Indian culture, and what is there which is actually making Indian culture special? Why does Swami speak so highly of Indian culture? If we want to identify them, these are the things you have to identify, and you will have to reinforce them. So what are those aspects of Indian culture that we have to identify as the foundations, and we have to reinforce them? In fact, Swami says in one of the discourses, I mean, this is a very important point that this is one of the very important points that Swami makes. of all the nations in the world, I'll quote that verbatim. Swami says, of all the nations in the world, India stands on the strongest foundation. So all that you refer to in the problems of the Indian society are like the cracks in the wall. But what Swami is saying is, never mind, you can always repair the walls, you can always repair the superstructure, but what's important is the foundations are very, very strong. So can we identify those foundations? And if we are looking at making Indian society better, we have to ensure that we reinforce these foundations, because as I'm going to enlist them, these are all three or four points which Swami has categorically made in his discourses. You will see that these, which are actually the strength of Indian culture, can also be its weaknesses. And many of the aspects of modern Indian culture, modern Indian societies that you were referring to in your question, stem from these strengths actually being contorted. So let me explain with relation to a few of them. We are a society of very, very strong family ties, right? As one Indian social scientist says, many Indians are corrupt, but will say, what is wrong? I'm after all providing for my family, right? You know, that is what is the logic that most of us use when we take to corrupt ways. I have a family, I need to feed them, there's nothing wrong. So in that sense, many the middle class men, the middle class families get caught up into this paradox of two dharmas. The dharma that a man has towards his family and the dharma as an individual of being righteous, being honest, being truthful. There is a clash of this thing. But Swami says that one of the backbones of the Indian culture is this interdependency of the society, which is best expressed as the family structure, which is so strong in our country. So though it appears that it's because of this family bondage and attachment that man is having, that he is having to push himself and do wrong things, one thing what we must remember is this is one of the strengths of the Indian culture, and at no cost we have to let that decay, right? So what really happens is, you know, there is a man who is, you know, probably his most important duty, let's say he's a householder, is to provide for the family. And one of the saddest things which is happening in the past few years in India is what we refer to as the farmer suicides. Thousands of farmers are, you know, unable to repay their loans, unable to continue their farming activities and make it profitable. So eventually are giving up their lives, which is a very, very sad thing. But if you look at it, you know, where else will you find this culture of a man who says that if I cannot provide for my family, my life is not worth living? That is how much he is duty bound. That's how much he feels that I owe to my family. I've given birth to children and it's my duty to take care of my children. If I am not in a position to take care of my children, then this life is not worth living. Again, I'm not justifying suicides. I'm not justifying that weakness in no measures. But the intensity of that duty-bounded nature of the, you know, the farmers in India, that really shows what is the strength of that family structure that I'm talking of. And Swami says that that is one of the very, very important aspects of Indian culture. In fact, one of the recent, again, another social scientist, he makes this point, when you talk about voting, it happens in many, many places still where the politicians buy votes. You know, they give money and they say that you vote for my party. It's a trend which is one of the corrupt ways in which happens still in our democracy. And there's this person who is referring to this and he says that this is a very queer thing. You know, you catch a person, you give him money and you tell him you vote for my party, which means you've corrupted him. You're buying his votes and you've corrupted him. But this man who's taken the money, when he goes into the voting booth, where nobody will know whom he has voted for, he will ensure that he will vote for the party that gave him money because he feels duty bound, because he says, I've taken money from them, I cannot cheat them. So there is this, I mean, absolute contradiction and paradox where you are honest, but you're not honest. You're corrupt and your honesty, you're trying to be honest in spite of you already being corrupt. And this is probably, you know, in many ways what is the feature of Indian society. And this happens because, again, going back to what I said about, the insecurities. When there are insecurities in life, what happens is what is right in front of you becomes more and more important. Just like what they say when you're in extreme stress, when you're, probably in danger, you're in the wild and an animal is after you, let's say a lion is after you, your immediate need is to keep yourself alive the next moment. And they say the brain thinks of only that. So when most of these people are in situations of insecurity, they're always thinking of that immediate benefit. Can I benefit the next moment and get, money for my family? And that is what drives them to that. Again, it's not right. I'm not saying that it's the right thing to do. But this is what happens. And this is compounded because of their attachment to their family. The more they are bound to their family, the more they tend to do this. But at the same time, if we want to reinforce Indian culture, we must ensure that we don't break down this family structure, but we reinforce it and we use it to propagate our values. Like it happens in many, many families. A son is constantly looking up to his father for approval. Whatever he does, he wants to make his father proud. That's one of the features of our Indian families. And the same thing is with the father. The moment he has children, he's automatically on alert. He wants to be an ideal to the children. He corrects his ways. He becomes more righteous. So in that way, we have to use the system to correct the flaws that are in it, but we must not discard it completely. Now, coming to the next aspect, which Swami speaks of, probably it comes off from that story of Ratnakara, who later becomes Valmiki. And Swami tells the story of this. He is a dacoit who goes around, mugging people, and once he comes across the Saptarishis, and he tells them that give me your possessions, and they say that we have no possessions, and the only true possessions that we have, you are not still worthy enough to receive it, and they were referring to the spiritual grace. So then they say that, they get into an argument, this dacoit and the Saptarishis, and then the dacoit says that, how can you say that what I'm doing is wrong? I have a family to feed, and I'm a family man. It is my duty to feed my family, right? And then the Saptarishis tell him that, yeah, you are doing it as a duty, but don't you know that whatever you do, you alone are responsible for your actions and not your family. And that is when they impress upon him the idea of karma. And that is exactly the next aspect of the Indian culture, which Swami says makes this culture foundationally strong. And that is the belief in karma. That is the belief that if I do good, good will come back to me. If I do bad, bad will come back to me. But the problem with this karma theory, if you look at it, is, when it is not backed by goodness, it will lead to a sense of apathy. When you see somebody suffering, you don't feel that, you don't feel that compassion spontaneously, because you feel that if somebody is suffering, he must have done something wrong in his past and that's why he's suffering. That again explains why in many times in society you feel that people are lacking compassion. People will see others suffer, but they're not really moved enough to go and help them. And this is actually the flip side or the bad aspect of karma, but the good aspect of karma is it gives you what Swami calls the fear of sin. And you will see this in Indian people. They will be corrupt and they will be doing wrong things, but when something wrong happens to them, they will automatically know that I've done something wrong to somebody and that's why this is coming back to me. And there are many, many cases where people will realize that, oh, I cheated that person, oh, I was unfair to this person, and they will immediately go and make amends when something starts happening bad in their life. So this belief in karma is actually central to the Indian culture, right? So this is something which we must always remember and again reinforce if we want to pass this on the Indian culture with all its strength. One is reinforcing what I said was the aspect of the family values or interdependency in a culture. It's not merely family values, it's even in social values. A neighbor can come and correct your son. If I'm doing something wrong, my uncle who's very, very far from me in relationship, even he can come and correct me. We are socially bound. If you go to Indian villages, the whole village lives like a single family, where each one is responsible and answerable to anybody in that village. That social structure is one of the strengths. This belief in karma, that what I do good will come back to me. that it may appear that the situation was not going to benefit me, but I've done what is right, I will get back what I need to get. That belief, and in the negative sense, if I do wrong, it's going to come back to me, that will lead to what we call fear of sin, right? So when there is belief in karma, the other thing which will happen is you will have a sense of acceptance of the problems that you're facing and the status that you are in life. Because you take responsibility for what you are. If you're not very well off, if you're very disadvantaged, if you're disabled, in many ways you take responsibility for what you are. This is usually seen as a negative aspect of culture, but this is actually a positive aspect of culture, because you accept what you are. There is a sense of acceptance, and when this sense of acceptance comes, you not only accept what you are, but you, in a very subtle way, start accepting everybody as they are. You don't force change upon anybody. You have a sense of universal acceptance of everybody. He says, yes, everybody has a path, everybody has a journey, everybody has their own choices. You respect that. And as Swami would tell in one of his discourses, you know, you should have unity, but you should not enforce uniformity. And that, as I said, the ethnic cleansing which happened in the colonial period, that came from that, because here was a civilization which was trying to impose itself on others. But the Indian culture was always about accepting, you know, this is how I am, I accept myself as I am, this is how you are, and I accept you as you are. As, you know, that is the strength of the Indian culture, that acceptance. And that acceptance is what Swami refers to as forbearance. It's actually called kshama, and the forbearance is a very light translation of that. But kshama is a very wise acceptance of what you are, your situation in life, and everybody around. And that leads to unity and diversity, which Swami would often talk about as one of the strengths of the Indian culture. You accept everybody. In fact, Max Muller, who speaks about the Sanatan Dharma aspect, he says that Sanatan Dharma follows a principle called, Henotheism, that's the word he uses. Henotheism is about you having many gods, but at the same time you believe that every god is as powerful as any other god. And he would refer to this about the verses in the Rig Veda. He would say that if you look at the Rig Veda, when it speaks about Indra, it says you are the supreme god. When it speaks about the sun god, it says you are the supreme god. When it speaks about Agni, when it speaks about Varuna, it speaks about Vayu. It refers to every deity and worships that deity as the supreme. He says this quality of Sanatana Dharma, which is referred to as henotheism, he says is the strength of this culture. I can be attached to my deity and it is right, and you can be attached to your deity as it is supreme and you can also be right. And this nature of Indian culture comes from forbearance. So as Swami said, these are the three pillars of the Indian culture, which are the interdependency in a society, which is expressed as family values, is expressed as the bonding that you have in a society between neighbors, between friends, between colleagues, and all of that. The second thing is the acceptance of karma, the understanding of the karma system. And it goes without saying that this belief that if not in this birth, in some birth you will have to come and repay the mistakes that you've done or enjoy the fruits of the actions that you've performed. So these are that is the second thing. And the third one, of course, is kshama, or forbearance, or acceptance of things as they are. And this kshama, the flip side of it is, as I said, it appears, I mean, when it is degraded and when it is not backed by the spiritual understanding, it shows up as what we call the chalta hai attitude. You know, you just don't take anything seriously in life, you just go on. You don't find the drive to change anything wrong that is happening. That comes from this sense of acceptance. But as Swami says, when you mix that acceptance with a sense of dharma, as a sense of my duty, you will find that, you know, it will be balanced out. It will not be in that state. And I started with speaking about insecurities. And in India, you know, most people turn to corruption to deal with insecurities. But there is another option which is available, and that actually is the essence of all of these, what we were speaking. Because when I was speaking about the foundation, Swami says, in fact, in that very same discourse, he says, the other aspect of Hinduism, or the Indian culture, the Bharatiya tradition, which nourishes all of these foundations. If you can have all of these foundations, but if this nourishment is not there, you will find the system crumbling down. And in many ways, that's what is happening. And Swami says that is, that can be referred to from the name of this country itself. Swami would say Bharata means the nation where the people are attached to God. Rati means attachment and Bha is God. Swami would say that the people of this land are attached to God. So when people go through life with many of these insecurities, you know, you're a farmer, you don't know how, you know, what are the market conditions going to be, what is the monsoon condition going to be, you don't know who the middleman is going to cheat you. There's so many insecurities in doing the simple thing. But what does the Indian man do? Yes, many of them turn to corruption, but most of them turn to prayer to God. At every stage they have a prayer. You know, if somebody builds a house, you have a bhumi puja. Before they start even breaking the, making the foundation, they have a puja. When the foundation is made, they have a puja. When the building is built, they have a puja. Then they have a Guru Pravesham puja. Then apart from that, you have so many things. All of this is, there are so many insecurities and uncertainties through the path. I am taking recourse in God to, you know, ensure that nothing bad happens. In the path of devotion, turning to God for any selfish need or any material need is considered as a lower aspect of devotion, because you're supposed to turn to God for the love of God. But turning to God in such a situation is far better than turning to any corrupt means. And we don't realize that, as I started by saying, that eventually for a system to get rigged, you don't need 100% of the people to be corrupt. You need only 2 or 3% to be corrupt. And once the system is rigged, you know, the others just follow. But most of the people in this land actually still turn to worship of God to face the insecurities in life. So going back to your question, I'm sorry, I probably have taken much, much, much longer than I should have to explain this. But if we are asking ourselves, so what is it that we need to correct about the society? What is it that we need to ensure that we don't, go back into a failed society? These are the things that we need to reinforce. We need to reinforce this social structure, the family structure, the interdependency. And that comes from leading lives which are based on duty. As I said in that, when I was speaking about the quote today, we have to lead duty-bound lives rather than rights and freedom-based lives. We need to bring up the next generation, injecting in them a sense of duty, a sense of dharma. What am I supposed to do? What is my roles? What are my responsibilities? That is something which we need to ensure that we give. And to keep this family structure or interdependency in our society intact. And the second thing is, of course, the fear of sin, which is brought about by the understanding in karma. You know, in the modern way, we discard some of these belief systems because we are not able to explain them. And we discard them because it appears a bit cruel, in a sense that you see a disabled person, you blame that disabled person for his disability. It appears like a very cruel thing to do. You know, and we see that in different aspects of crimes in our country. We tend to, blame the person who has been unfairly treated. But yes, we probably have to be more cultured in the way we speak about it. But the truth is that the acceptance of karma theory should not be removed, because that is one of the foundations. And the third thing is forbearance. Becoming restless at every injustice that we face is not a way in which we are going to make any, we're going to contribute any better to this culture. There should be forbearance, and that forbearance should be contained in a balance through a sense of duty. And at every time, it's not like I don't react at all, but is it my duty to react? If it is my duty to react, then I should react and I will react. So these three things, and all of these three things, have to be nourished by what Swami calls as that devotion. And in fact, many, many times when Swami speaks about the Indian culture, Swami would say that this is the land in which God chooses to incarnate again and again and again and again. You know, when we talk about patriotism, when I say that I love my country, when I say I love India, it means that I'm born in this country and India is my motherland, and just like how I've not chosen my mother, but I still love my mother, I've not chosen this country for its virtues. Apparently it doesn't appear so. Maybe in the past I must have, but in the present it doesn't appear like I've chosen India as my country, but still because I'm born in India, I love India. But if you look at Swami, Swami had the choice. The whole world was open to him. He could have been born anywhere. But God, Swami says, time and again chooses to be born in this land. Well, it could mean two things. One thing is, you know, you need solution where the problem is. Probably God is the solution and nobody has more problems than us. But Swami says, if you want to plant a seed, you have to plant it where the soil is fertile. And Swami says, for the avatar to be born, this land is fertile. This land is fertile because the people of this land have attachment towards God. When they have problems, they turn to God. When they are happy, they turn to God. In festivities, they turn to God. In celebration, they turn to God. And this is a nature that we should ensure and do whatever it takes to keep this alive. The interesting thing is, I was reading somewhere, there are these many schools of Hindu philosophy. Right? You have Sankhya and Vaisheshika, Advaita, Dvaita, and many of these different schools of Hindu thought. I think there are about 16 of them. Right, and this person, I don't recall who the author was, he was saying that if you go into the philosophy of all of these schools of Hindu thought, you will realize that probably 14 or 15 of them are strongly atheistic. They don't speak about God being an entity and you should have devotion to it. And he says it's a surprise that in a land which has produced such atheistic ways of looking at spirituality, the love for God has still lasted. The love for God is still fresh. And that is fresh because God comes time and again in a human form and rekindles that love. So if we really want to do service to this country, we want to ensure that we bring it back into track. Yes, the cosmetic changes we need to do, whatever you're talking about is efficacy and social life, efficacy, you know, the way you behave in a bus, the way you behave in a metro, all of that have to be taught to our children. In fact, Swami himself mentions it. We were looking at a Kodai video where Swami speaks of that. He said, this is one thing that you all should learn from Westerners. See the way they speak. They speak very politely. They say thank you. They say sorry. You know, they are polite, the gentlemanliness and all of that is there. You need to learn that, but that is the cosmetic change that we need to bring. But if you want to retain the real core of this culture, for which Swami always praises this culture, that is, these three ideas of forbearance, or kshama, or acceptance, this interdependency, that I am ready to help another person. And if you look at it, if you really go into the villages, the kind of help that one person will give to the other is far more than what you talk of as, you know, giving a person a seat in the bus, or, you know, being kind, not playing loud music. Yes, these are all very, very important. But if you go into some of these villages, as you know, Swami would send us for Gram Seva, we would see the kind of compassion that you and I cannot relate to. If there's a disaster, the way one family will help the other. You know, we've seen cases where probably a family has suddenly had a disaster and the parents have passed away. The child would be so very effortlessly absorbed into the neighbor's house as one of the adopted children. And it's a poor family. It's not a family which has enough money to spare for another child. But they would say, but what do we do? It's our responsibility. Our neighbor has passed away and this child is orphaned. We need to take care of him. And these are not aberrations in our culture, but these are regularities. And the last point that I will make is something which we would often make when we were doing the Ramayana satsang as part of the afternoon satsang. You know, many times the epics that we pass on to our children, the Ramayana, the Mahabharata, the Bhagavad Gita, the Puranas, and all of these stories, they are very, very idealistic. We may be far from those ideals. We may be far from the personality of somebody like Rama, the way he lived. We might be very, very far from the the brotherhood that existed between the Pandava brothers. But when we pass these as epics, as stories to our children, we are telling them that this is the ideal. This is the standard that you have to set for yourself. We may or may not be able to live up to that standard, but we will know that this is our ideal. At any time, we don't lower the bar. So, if we really want to, you know, strengthen the culture, and as you said, to ensure that this spirituality which is inside, it also shows outside, these are the three or four foundations which have to be fostered. These are not my explanations, these are very, very categorically spoken of by Swami, but it's a very important question. I'm very grateful for that question, because many of us who have had the opportunity to observe some of these Western society are really taken aback, and I can be honest that this is a question which has occurred in my mind, that Swami speaks so highly of India, but we don't find this kind of culture which I see in a Western country in my Indian city. This is a thought which strikes all of us. But as I said, if what Swami says is opposed to what meets our eyes, it only means that we need to look deeper into to find the real truth. So for that, thank you, Ms. Praveena Kilpadi, for this beautiful question. I wonder if my answer was as good as the question was, but if you really have any more doubts on what I've said, you can always write to me at prem@radiosound.org. With that, dear listeners, I better wind up. I've taken a lot of time. Thank you for being with me. Thanks once again to the person who asked the question on this week. If you have a question on practical spirituality or on Swami's message and implementing it on daily life, and I would be very glad if you send it to me, I can feature it on this program. All you have to do is record your question in your own voice and send it to prem@radiosai.org, which is my personal mail ID. So the mail that you send to that mail ID will be read only by me. So if you wish to be anonymous, you can let me know. I most humbly offer this at Swami's lotus feet. I'm going to leave you with a very, very beautiful padyam which Swami would sing, which is absolutely in sync with the answer that we gave today. In a short while from now, you will be joined by Raghu for the Ashtotram program, and after that, I'll be here with Arvind for the afternoon satsang. We might be delayed by 5 to 10 minutes because all our programs are delayed by about 10 minutes. Sorry about that, but thank you for being with me. And I'm going to leave you with this beautiful, beautiful padyam, which has been set to music by some devotees.
Samara Bhumi, సంగీత సాహిత్యం సస్య విజ్జలందు శక్తి చూపిన దివ్యభూమి. చిత్రకళనతోడ చిత్రమైనట్టి భరత భూమి యందు జననముంది. భరత మాత ధర్మ భాగ్యము కపాడ బాధ్యతంతయు మీదే భక్తులార. భరత మాత ధర్మ భాగ్యం బుకపాడ బాధ్యతంతయు మీదే భక్తులారా. బాధ్యతంతయు మీదే భక్తులారా. ఖండ ఖండా